This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. Are you ready to discover your True North Story? With your hosts, Tama Fulton and John Hudson Messerol.
KHJ Los Angeles.
Portions of the day's programming are reproduced by means of electrical transcriptions or tape recordings.
Get them for you.
Okay, thank you. We'll hold.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
We are doing really well, John, and we are so excited to talk to you. I can't stand it.
Man.
Yes.
Tama and John Hudson Messerol, my word.
You got it.
I just love saying his full name. I hope you don't mind, Tama.
No, he actually prefers that.
I do. I go by the three names now.
You started a trend, John Willard.
That's right. I love it.
I do, too. Just realizing that, you know, because I don't think about it every day, I get to be the blessed one who voices portions of your program, your podcast. And that's incredible to me.
That whole story, that was not a coincidence. John and I do not believe in coincidences.
We do not.
I'm guessing you don't either. But you reached out to me on social media, and I let you know about the podcast, and you blessed us with your incredible talent to talk on our podcast.
He brings us together in ways that, you know, when you look back, I mean, things that happened a decade ago or two decades ago and thought I was so smart and conniving and coordinating something, but I had no idea, you know, the ramifications or the ripples that would touch so many people until you look back on it and go, wow, thank you, Lord. You know, you did that.
You know, the rear view is a great place to look and be able to see. It's not so easy when you're in the middle of it, but boy, I'll tell you what, when you look back and you can say, wow, look at how those dots got connected. Wow, look at how this arc tied into this one, and it sends a powerful message.
Preach it, brother. I'll try.
This is so funny. This is so funny. Tam and I always joke, we're talking about, do you remember the test that we took when we were kids to tell us what we're supposed to be when we grow up? Okay.
What was yours?
Funeral director or preacher? So I'm not sure. Podcast host is probably somewhere in the middle. I'm not sure.
Tama, how about you?
You know, I think I was supposed to be a dental hygienist.
Really?
Well, you do have lovely gums and teeth, I must tell you that.
Exactly.
Well, thank you.
I'll second that. What about you, John? What do you remember they said you should do?
Ditch digger.
No way.
I don't remember.
With a voice like that?
I don't remember. I really don't remember. I mean, here's how far back I go to elementary school. I actually remember taking part in the duck and cover exercises.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You.
And you.
And you.
And you.
Duck. And cover.
Be sure and remember what Bert the Turtle just did, friends, because every one of us must remember to do the same thing. That's what this film is all about. Duck and cover.
That was a product of those years of the Soviet scare and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, the Cold
War. Did your
War.
Folks have a bomb shelter in the backyard?
No, they just prayed a lot.
Oh, that's great.
My parents must tell you that they both were the most genuinely living out their faith people who I've ever seen, and I got to see it up close, and it was real, and I came from really, I don't want to say poverty, but we were not well off at all. My dad was a pastor of churches that if you cracked 100 people on a Sunday morning, that was a huge thing. Yeah, but I remember churches where there were 60 people coming for Sunday mornings.
Were you born and raised in Georgia, John?
No.
Okay.
In Wilmore, Kentucky, there is Asbury Theological Seminary. My dad went there after World War II, and then my mother went to Asbury College. And I just finally saw these beautiful institutions up close for myself when I went on a radio road tour that I visited clients in the southeast, and I stopped into, it's just south of Lexington, Kentucky, which is where I was born. And when I walked around these hallowed walkways and looked at these beautiful buildings, I realized my parents were greater than I even thought. This was a prestigious institution.
You're growing up in Kentucky, is that right? And then this is a really interesting question, because one thing that's bubbled up with some of the guests that we've talked to is parents setting not only an example of how to live, but also being either encouraging to the pursuit of your passion or maybe not so encouraging. And so tell us a little bit about how supportive they were in your endeavors in the beginning.
Oh, that's a really great question. I was born in Lexington, but we moved by the time I was not quite 2 years old. We were out in California. So I did a lot of growing up in Southern and Northern California and in Reno, Nevada, places that my dad's pastorate would take us to. And I know parents who have said, no, don't do that, you know, who have really dissuaded and crushed the spirits of their children, just stopping it out of them. But my parents saw that I was musical from a very early age. In fact, my mom wrote down, she's written a lot of things that we kids did. And this is one she told me, but I have read it too, since she has passed away. And my dad passed away a little over 10 years ago. And she passed away early last year. So I have been able to read a number of things that she wrote about us kids, and it's just really sweet. One of the things she wrote was, you were 6 months old sitting on my lap, and this men's quartet from a local college came and sang, and there was such beat to it that you just couldn't help yourself, and you were rocking back and forth on my lap. And then I remember by age 4, I was performing solos, you know, vocal solos. Both my parents were classically trained, and they were beautiful voices, each one of them, as soloists, but they also sang duets. And I remember them singing all the churches that my dad ever pastored. You know, they were called upon to sing in a number of occasions. By the time I was in elementary school, I was going to a school in the Los Angeles County area that had an orchestra. All the schools had orchestras. And we had a wonderful teacher by the name of Ralph Metesky, who would go from school to school, and once a week we would have this time with Ralph Metesky, who was, if people look him up, they can find that he's one of the leading string composers and arrangers for youth in America. I didn't realize what a great man, but he went on to head up the music department at the University of Southern California after I got to work with him. He would take the best players from all these various elementary schools and then put them in a collective orchestra that was called the Festival Orchestra. We had about 110 instrumentalists and everything from, you know, all the strings, everything that you find in an orchestra. And I started on last chair trumpet, third part, last chair. You could only be there fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. That was the eligible years. So I worked so hard from that year through the summer, and I'll never forget this. This is one that's seared in my memory, and I think my hat's off to this man for believing in me, and what I'm going to tell you was one of those seminal moments that I've told people about. The very first rehearsal that we had, we would meet at Saturday morning at 8 for 2 hours. All our orchestra is all settled in, and I'm sitting back there at my previous last chair place, third trumpet, and Ralph Metesky stands up on the podium, and he looks over everybody, and he sees me, and he goes, "Willard, first chair."
Whoa.
In front of everybody. And I'm telling you, that was a mark upon my life. And, I mean, yes, I earned it, but for him to claim me as worthy of that spot, and then from that point on, I think his belief in me, merely saying that publicly, caused me to be first chair in every orchestra and band from then on through college. Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, to the point where I remember going to another school, and I was a ninth grader, and I challenged the senior in a blind audition, and I won first chair.
It sounds like a pretty strong belief in yourself, too.
And therein lies, to the heart of your question, my parents really sacrificed, and they really believed in me. I mean, when I know they couldn't afford a nice trumpet, I mean, my dad bought me a used one, and then he bought me then the following year, he bought me a really fine trumpet that was, even though it was used, it was just one of the, I don't know if he realized what a great, rare trumpet it was. It was a French Miha made by Bessin, and it's a very rare trumpet.
Wow.
And then to buy music lessons, private lessons, that was a huge thing.
Sure.
And I just found out, did a little Googling, actually earlier this week, and I found out that that school district was so poor that only 11% of the students could afford private lessons. I was a recipient of that, and my parents, I'm sure they sacrificed and scrimped, and, you know.
Sure.
They both said, by their actions and by their words, you can do anything that you want. Music has been so important to me.
Did you head off to school then to be a professional musician, or at what point did things turn for you to pursue radio?
Oh, that's so good. I don't know if you've done any research, but that was a great question. You know, I wanted to be, my pipe dream in high school, I was a very serious trumpet player, and I thought I was going to be a studio musician.
Okay.
You know, like
yeah.
go to Hollywood and just play trumpet on various sessions. But instead, I left, the first time I left home, find myself in California. This was coming probably at the heels, at the very tail end of the hippie movement. I remember walking around San Francisco and hearing these conga drums and bongo drums, and you could hear them for, it seems like, miles away. And then as you got closer, you would see half a dozen of them, and then they would grow to a dozen and maybe 15, and they would just play for hours like that. And of course, the aromas in the air.
Yeah.
Interesting to me too.
But yes.
protests were still going on in the Bay Area. So it was, you know, it was chaotic. But I went to a small liberal arts private college that had a radio station. Well, I worked up there for 6 hours a day. I signed them off at midnight, and I realized, you know, later when I'd go back to my dorm room, hey, I've got some schoolwork to do. Well, the schoolwork kind of took second place, and after a year there, I was hired by a local small radio network, and that was my first paying job. So right after my freshman year, I started working full-time. And radio, you know, as you know, it's a bug that infect you and bite and keep biting.
It gets in your bloodstream, doesn't it?
Sure did with me.
So you never looked back?
No, and I never did anything else. I started in broadcasting, and of course, I mean, let's say different incarnations, to the point where 25 years ago now, I would realize that I could make a living just doing imaging voice work.
For 25 years, you've done that, supported yourself and your family that way.
In the summer of 91, I really didn't know what you called it. We know what it is now, that it's imaging voice for a radio station. And my first station was a country station. It was KZLA in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about that was, and that was a God-appointed thing, too. I had a buddy who was, we had worked together in Atlanta, and he ends up being the morning guy. His name is Ken Cooper. And Ken says, would you do some production for me? Would you do some liners and promos just for the morning show? So I thought, well, I guess he's already cleared this with the higher-ups. So I'm dealing directly with him, and I'm not only voicing it, fully producing it on reel-to-reel, send it overnight FedEx. He carts it up, puts it on the air. First day, he tells me this later on the phone later that day. He said the program director came in after he got to the station and said, who's that? And he explains, a program director like that, if it hadn't been cleared, he had every right to say, get him off the air.
Sure.
Instead, he said, let's put him on the whole station. And little did I know that the station was assaulted by the late, great Rusty Walker, who was the preeminent country consultant in America.
How about that?
Oh, it was amazing. From that point on, I was getting calls either every day or every other day, just out of the blue, asking for demos. And this is old school. I would send them out on cassette. I mean, that's how we did it.
Yeah.
I'd ask them, well, how'd you find out about me? And they'd say, Rusty Walker asked us to call you. So
how wild is that?
It would take another about 4 or 5 years until I actually met him. And I met him at a country radio seminar with all his team. Oh, wow. They were really champions in my corner. I just owe my career to them.
When you were working in radio, you weren't necessarily working in the country music genre over your previous career?
No, it's interesting that was my first foray, was KZLA. And then because of Rusty, and I took another look at country music and remember what was happening back then. You know, we had Clint Black was coming on the scene and Mark Chestnut and certainly Garth Brooks.
I was just going to say Garth.
Yeah. He'd blow the doors down. Yeah.
Friends in low places when there's something. Something like that.
And Winona and Susie
I got
Fogg
friends in low places. Yeah, okay. All right,
yeah. And the Judds. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. And, you know, that was very attractive to me. You know, to take another look at country. And then I realized what wonderful people, the people in the business, were just salt of the earth as well.
That's interesting a minute, John. Let me just digress here for 1 minute. So there's kind of like this change happening in country, right, at that time from, say, the Merle Haggards and the Johnny Cashes and the traditional old school country. And then, you know, we've got this new brand of music that's coming on the scene that we just talked about. And it's becoming a lot more mainstream, a lot more popular. It's not just this small segment that likes this old school country. And the politics is involved there a little bit, right? Because you've got, you were talking about the 60s and Vietnam and that whole thing. And I'm not sure that conservative country was playing too well in some parts of the country. And then when, you know, the newer country came on board, that was more for a mass audience, right?
Yeah, it really was. I think it just kind of washed over the nation. And it was a fresh appeal. There were the Waylon Jennings and the Merle Haggards. Yeah,
right.
Okie
from Muskoka.
Yeah, you know. The outlaws, the angst.
Yeah.
Perhaps it was the era of Bill Clinton, you know. I mean,
There you go.
President Bubba, you know, the whole thing.
Hey, we might get part due here in this fall.
True.
We don't weigh into politics on True North Story, but I will say...
I'd say you do a pretty good, Bill.
I would say you got more work lined up for you.
You know, that's so funny. I pull that out every now and then. I actually did make some money, certainly not like my friend Ben Campbell, who's been the preeminent voice of Barack Obama.
Right.
He's been on some... You probably know who I'm talking about.
Oh, sure.
Who's a co-host. Yeah, tremendous talent. He does everybody, but he's... I mean, that was a goldmine, I think. But I did, during the Bush... Gore campaign in 2000, and I actually wrote part of it or ad-libbed part of it to kind of punch it up, and it was me doing President Bubba.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's great.
It was fun. I wish I don't have a copy of it.
You got a Donald Trump you can bring out, John?
You know, I don't. I don't. I mean,
that's a tough one, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it takes a little bit of, I got to listen to it a little closely.
Is there a business for you to impersonate voices?
There is for somebody when you're that talented. I think people like, you know, the Frank Caliendos of the world have it down, and I'm just blessed to do what I get to do, which is to say that I don't throw in additional voices and even singing from time to time. I mean, I'm asked by stations to sing on tracks. They'll rewrite a piece of a well-known song. I'm thinking of one was, well, you said Friends in Low Places.
Yeah, I got Friends in Low Places.
It was something about tickets, and we've got two tickets in high places.
Oh, right.
And it was really funny, and it was, so I was singing to the Garth track, and it was for a station in Salt Lake City that was really inventive with their promo idea, so I just jumped on board, did as best I could. But I'm just so blessed that I have clients who say, go off the page. You know, we like what you do when you're not reading it verbatim. Sometimes you make it better than what we wrote, so. You know, there's flexibility. I'm not saying I do that all the time. I'm just saying there's great flexibility. People know what they can expect from me. And hey, after 25 years, I better be doing it right.
True North Story, the original podcast series, meant to inspire, encourage, motivate, and offer hope. Now, back to the program.
You are a professional, that is for sure, because I will tell you that we get lots of comments on our intros for True North Story. We let everybody know as often as we can who the voice is behind True North Story, which is you.
I'm proud of it.
Yeah, well, we're blessed and appreciative and so
proud
thankful, John.
To be associated.
Tell us, John, how you got involved announcing at the CMA Awards.
I was the first non-Nashville, I was out of talent or voiceover person to voice the show. Keith Bilbrey from WSM had done it a couple of years, two or three years before, right up until I took over. And Ralph Emery had voiced it 12 years.
Wow.
The year that I met Ralph Emery in a show right before one of the CMA Awards, I think it was probably in the late 90s when we used to hold it at the Grand Ole Opry, I introduced myself to him, and he smiled real broadly and said, well, I voiced the show for 12 years. And as I walked away, I said, I'm going to do it at least 13 years. and last year, I hit number 20.
Holy cow.
Yeah, so I hold, you know, so after 12, I held the record, and I guess if they have me back and I'm not under contract, I'm always wondering, are they going to have me back, you know, from year to year. I usually get the call a few weeks ahead, and this will be the 50th anniversary, so this will be my 20th show.
My goodness.
21st.
21st. That's a big deal. That's
awesome. Do you walk the red carpet then?
I get in trouble for walking the red carpet. A couple of years ago, I being a little silly and, shall we say, pushing the envelope, and you have to have somebody, an escort, and then they actually write the name down on a piece of paper and hold the clipboard up for the photographers. There was one photographer who was there taking pictures for Getty, and I know her. I actually introduced her to the country world back several years ago at one of the country radio seminars in Nashville, and she's one of the finest concert photographers and celebrity photographers in the business today. And so she yells out, kind of really surprised, you know, and so I gravitated toward her and looked at her, and nobody ever published any of the pictures, you know. They didn't want to see who the announcer was.
Have you gotten to know any of the artists at all? Consider any of them acquaintances or friends?
One of the earliest and closest, and we're pretty close, Mark Wills.
Mm. Oh,
And Mark did a really funny thing. Mark was a real big wrestling fan, or he would say wrestling. And this is when World Championship Wrestling was really big and beating Monday Night Football on ABC. They actually were eclipsing the ABC ratings with their Monday Nitro on TNT. And I happened to be the voice of World Championship Wrestling for about 6.5 years until they sold
it. Did you really?
Yeah, that was some WCW, you know, all that real.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Who was
Papa Pump?
Oh, there you go. Okay, I was going to ask.
Rick
like
Steiner, the Steiner brother, you know, all that kind of stuff. In the Squared Circle, a no-holds-barred Texas tornado, you know, that kind of stuff.
That is unbelievable.
So,
I love it.
I'm not warmed up to do that, but
sounds pretty damn good to me.
Super Bowl Sunday. Sting and Lex Luger battle the Steiners for the World Tag Team Championship. And Giant Elegante faces Sid Vicious in a stretcher match plus more. Super Bowl Sunday. Bring the action home live May 19th, only on pay-per-view.
Wow.
But it was a lot of fun, and so he knew me from doing that, and one day, it was CMA Awards Week, where all the artists go and they do the rounds with the radio interviews, and we were leaving where all those stations do the interviews with the artists, because the artists are just coming in left and right, and just one after the other. He had just done something. We walked out together, and I was walking behind him, and so there are fans that line up along this little stanchion, and instead of acknowledging them and, hey, I'm Mark Wills, he turns around and points to me and says, that's John Will, you're the voice of World Championship Wrestling. I'll never forget it. It was the craziest thing, Mark Wills.
Do people ask you, I just have to ask this question, I'm sorry, John, but I just have to, like, when they find out that you are this amazingly talented voice personality, do they ever ask you, like, at a cocktail party, just give me a little something? You know, like whether the monster truck thing, or can you give me a little? I mean, do you run into that all the time? Let me hear.
You know, I used to, and I would say something like, "Well, show me how you deliver the mail."
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
If I do that, you show me something.
Yeah. Exactly.
That is kind of funny, though.
Is it? You
I
know,
think, and I what I feel sorry for are the actors who have an iconic line. You know,
right?
Somebody like a Clint, like how many times did Clint Eastwood have somebody who had a few too many martinis come up to him at a cocktail party and say, "Do me the line, you know, punk, you know,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
feel lucky,
punk." Yeah. That's so funny you bring
up. It's so true.
It is. It is. And it's so funny you bring up Clint Eastwood. And I'm sorry, I'm going to digress here for a minute. But one of my favorite lines that I always tell Tam, and she gets so tired of hearing it, but I'm going to say it anyway, is from a. Yeah, please. Please insert dramatic sigh. Is from Magnum Force when he played Dirty Harry, and he says at the end, you know, Hal Holbrook was, you know, the commissioner, and he gets blown up, and he says, you know, man's got to know his limitations. And I just always love that line because I'm like, you know what? There's no more probably singular truthful statement in all of life is we must know our limitations. And if we do that, it's a better way to live your life because then you're within the means. And like you said about being God inspired and seeking his purpose and will for the direction of our lives and some of the paths that we take. When you know your limitations, you're trusting it to somebody else.
I'm going to go to YouTube and look that line up.
Go. It's the end of Magnum Force.
All there. Anything you want to see, it's all there.
Exactly. 1973.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, you know, living in the... not living beyond where you know you should be. And I think it's kind of interesting that there is great freedom when we follow what God expects of us rather than those who poke and push and say, and you know, I want to live this way or I just want to do it my way. We could go off on a...
Yeah, exactly. It goes in a totally different direction, you know, but but that's really amazing. So has your journey kind of, as you got into radio and then and you got deeper into the imaging side of the house, have you ever wanted to do anything or go in any direction that you haven't yet or that you would like to in the future?
I think two areas. One, seriously, probably the overriding of the two, and that would be the movie trailer work. And I have done that type of read, you know, that type of voiceover, but I haven't really done the thing that Don LaFontaine was known for, the late, great Don LaFontaine, who did, they say, over 5,000 movie trailers.
That's a lot.
He was the king. As well as, and this is the second one, animation. I would love to be able to do recording in ensemble setting. Those are two that have eluded me, but that's all right. I'm not complaining. I'm having a blast doing what I get to do.
And you never know. We interview filmmakers. We interview writers. And Tama and I have kind of, this is the amazing thing with True North Story. We've really just turned it over, and we're trying to get guests and people to share their stories like you, John, that are inspiring and encouraging and motivating. And you've done it. You know, you've read it. You're our voice. And offer hope to people to inspire them to do things. And if there are things you haven't done that you want to do, maybe one day you will. I mean, it's just...
Well, I love the guests you've had. Some of the early ones that just blew me away, Alabama Shakes.
For
that
sure.
That was incredible. That was before they...
Right.
Well, yeah. That was right before their 6 Grammys. Yeah,
absolutely.
That was...
Absolutely.
When you left Kentucky as a child, a 2-year-old, and then you went to L.A., Southern California, how did you end up then back in Atlanta?
Answering your previous question, which was you talked about country, and I wasn't always country. And when I was in radio, I worked in Christian radio, and then I wanted to spread my wings and have some fun and get crazy and get crazy with commercial radio. Yeah, so
there you go.
I get to program and be on the afternoons, true top 40 station. This is when we actually broke, or I don't want to say we broke, but we
who'd
debuted.
You put on the map?
Yeah, we debuted Michael Jackson's From the Bad.
Really?
Their first single,
yeah.
I Just Can't Stop Loving You.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll never forget that because that's one of the first CDs that we ever received. It was on compact disc, and boy, we put that on the air. I produced an intro to it to say that it was our world premiere. We played it about every hour and a half. You know, we played the heck out of it.
How cool is
and,
that?
Oh, it was so great. So things were too easy. I was winning all the day parts. I mean, I was beating my morning show with my afternoon show, and I beat all the other stations, all their day parts as well. And then I was producing, you know, the imaging for our station because I was really, really inspired by the Bay Area stations like KFRC and KYA. Back in the day, they were really duking it out, and I heard some competitive true top 40 radio. So they were inspiring me, and I was putting that on the air for our station, which was KWIN, K-W-I-N. It was licensed to Stockton and Lodi, California. I felt like, kind of a big fish in a small pond, and I was not being challenged any longer. I sent my resume and my tape, which, of course, in our business is the calling card, the tape, the demo, and I sent that to a headhunter. I had never used one before, never really heard of one. He lived in Woodstock, Georgia, just north of Atlanta. And
right.
Within 24 hours, I heard that my tape had gone through 94Q, which was a legendary station in Atlanta. And 3 weeks later, we're moving in.
I mean, holy
cow.
So
fast. Yeah, it happened so fast. That was that's what got us out here, and love of the South is what has kept us here.
That was a big, kind of a culture shock for you, though, wasn't it? Or no?
Well, it was more so for my wife, because she had never even visited the South. I mean, she had been in the Illinois area.
Okay.
Lived around there, but had never even visited the South. And I knew the South. My dad's side of the family was all in Charlotte, North Carolina. So there was that enchantment with how beautiful things and the quality of life and the way that they build homes and, you know, just all that. And so I knew it was going to be great, but she had to have a little.
She's like, trust. We're going where? You're taking me where?
And then she never
Georgia.
Wanted to.
And John, you are quite the runner, I must say.
Did one today, did a true 5K distance, and it was, you want to hear it? 86% humidity.
I hear you, brother. It's, that humidity is killer.
It's been hotter than usual. And then the hills, some of the geography that I will, for instance, in the Kennesaw battlefield, that was a big Civil War site right before Sherman went through and annihilated Atlanta. There was
right.
a big hold for about 30 days, kind of in my neck of the woods here. And the Kennesaw National Battlefield is a site where there's a beautiful visitor center. There's lots of sightseeing and things. But they also have trails back in there. And there was one, I mean, this will show you just how hilly it is. On my Nike Plus running app, I saw that there was 900 feet elevation change. That was my route for the day, 900 feet.
Wow. You know what?
Crazy.
That is insane, because I ride my bike. But, yeah, you don't notice as much. And like, I had a cyclometer app thing on my phone that when I was riding my bike, I would snap it on. And you start seeing some of the elevations on your ride, and you're kind of, whoa, you know? There's some... It doesn't feel, you know, it kind of sneaks up on you. You're like, wow, that's so running.
I should be riding my mountain bike more. I love mountain bikes. You probably have a speed bike. But
yeah.
Oh, let's see. What was that? Oh, what were we talking about? I'm glad this is tape.
Yeah, no.
We're live on the podcast. Well, this is our first ever live.
And we'll be right back with more John Williard when he remembers what he was going to say.
I did a little bit of CNN when the Gore-Bush vote was deadlocked, and on a Saturday, you probably remember when the Supreme Court, you know, knocked that
right.
out, and there was a breakthrough, and I happened to call a guy who I had done some work for on a completely different thing. I knew he was a CNN topical promo producer, head of that department, but we were doing a spot for the Hawks, the Atlanta Hawks basketball team. That's how I got to know him, know his background. So I just called him and said, left a message and said, if you can't get your main guy, I'm available. I'm here. I'm right here at the studio, you know, which is in my house. Kind of convenient. And he called 5 minutes later and said, let's go. So now, about 6 months after that, I'm doing some work in another studio, and I got a page. Remember pagers? Well, my pager went off. And I called them, and they said, get down here. It was CNN. And they said, get down here right away. It's really important. So I was just a few miles away. So I got down there to the CNN promo department office, and they said, we just fired, and I won't give the name of the guy, but it was a guy who had done it for all of the 90s. He had been their voice for 10 years. And they said, you're it.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was like, oh, okay, so, and then... They said, we'd also like you to do CNN headline news. We'd like you to be the voice there. And we'd also like you to do CNN International topical promos as well, on a temporary basis, because we're looking for somebody with a kind of a Western European accent. And I thought, oh, okay, 2 or 3 weeks. No, that went on for 18 months like that.
Holy cow.
Side. Yeah, but I did a lot. I did for the next 10, 12, 14 years, had, you know, quite a relationship with CNN. I would do the promos, you know, back in that era, Larry King was a big, did
right.
a lot of promos for Larry King and Wolf Blitzer and all the, and
Wolf.
It seemed like I got to do all these, it seemed like on weekends, I would get a call. I remember doing the promo when President Reagan passed away.
Oh,
another
okay.
another one when Bhutto was assassinated. Another one when Saddam Hussein was captured. Another one when the space shuttle blew up. It seemed like there were just some real milestone, you know, big stories that I got to do the first promos. I'll never forget those.
I would say not. My goodness.
So it's been a blessing, and you know, I know that I am literally twice the age of a lot of the, twice as old, I should say, as a lot of the guys who are firmly in the business, not just the up-and-comers, but the guys who are really knocking down some big work. So I've had to be kind of work smart and reinvent myself and, you know, and stay up and kind of be a Renaissance man, as it were, and just stay competitive.
Well, that said, do you have a website, John?
I would love to maintain it better, but it's just myname.com.
Okay.
It's just MYNAME. No, not my name. My name is John Williard.com.
And do you have demos on there, John?
I do have some work on there.
You have your agent's contact information and a place where people can reach out to
yes,
you.
Yes, I do, as a matter okay. of fact. Thank you for...
Okay. Well, yeah. Hey, has there
I was smart enough to put that on there.
Good. I'm so glad. I'm
and
glad
I must
to
say, I must give props to my talent agency out of New York City. I think they are the finest in the nation. It's Atlas Talent.
Wow.
They represent some really, really great people.
That's saying something.
Oh, John, thank you so much for being part of True North Story in every capacity.
You.
You're on every week, but it's just good to get to know you as a person a bit better.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to True North Story, the series. Follow us on Twitter at True North Story and tune in next time for another True North Story.